welcome to a episode of the Substation Podcast. My name is Tom Edwards, and I'm joined by my colleague Emma Burns, and we are joined by Alex Shock from Octopus Energy, and we are hoping to discuss with him the blog on intelligent demand that Octopus Energy have put out. But this is part of our series on demand management, I think we're calling it.
The role of demand in energy. And I think we in our first episode, we outlined a number of topics beneath that. So things like energy efficiency, energy rationing. And I guess this is our deep dive on demand side response, or intelligent demand, as it may now be known.
I think we categorized it as something like using demand in a way that responds to a signal, whatever that signal might be. Would you agree with that, Alex?
Yes, and I think the big question is the speed of response and how dynamic the response is. And in that, you kind of have the big difference of what is demand-side response versus intelligent demand. And I think, you know, if we think about it from a system level, historically, we've been just solving for a demand shape or curve. And we've turned up generators and turned down generators to meet a pretty static general kind of, you know, national or regional or supranational kind of picture. And, you know, as I'm looking forward to chatting with you about that, how does that concept evolve? What are the roots of that concept? And what do we actually need on a go forward basis for a cheaper to run and operate renewable energy system?
So this historic version of load management, essentially, I think that would be the kind of old way of describing it, is you've got a pretty stereotypical demand curve. We know when people wake up, when they turn the lights on, when most of them come home. And if you aggregate, I think I once heard in a work group meeting that if you aggregate up about 250 households, that's the point at which they start to look like the national profile. Wow. On average.
When did that apply to, right? Because we used to be a lot more similar on average than in the past than we probably will be in the future.
Yeah, that was a couple of years. That probably would have been about 2015, 2016, I think. So it's been a while since I've sat in a profiling group. So it might be very different nowadays. Yeah, that's the kind of general grouping, and that a network operator would be able to say, okay, well, I've got thousands of households, they're all going to roughly, you know, together, I can reasonably easily plan this based on what they did last year and how many of them there are. I think in your piece is quite good in categorizing the problem and talking about it. So there's you set out what demand side response is in your category and why it's not fit for the future. Would you be able to go into that a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, the way that you look at, if we look at kind of load management, I think that's a great, Tom, I think that's a great way of thinking about it, is that, you know, we're coming from a world of large centralized power plants where you're really solving for running them most efficiently, like very much analogous to what's the most effective way to run a factory. It's to run it at, you know, 99.9% utilization. Like, you don't ever want, you know, a factory not producing something, because the minute you do that, you have incremental costs. In the same way that, you know, large centralized power stations, you wanted them run most effectively and most efficiently. You didn't want to actually have to throttle them. You didn't want to have to kind of turn a big coal power station, let alone a nuke, up or down, right? You wanted to kind of shape the load to solve for your generation asset. And that's where, like, historically, demand side responses come in. It's like, okay, well, we've got, you know, in the UK context, or actually in a lot of Western European context, we've got electrified storage heating and immersion hot water resistive water heating. And, like, you know, okay, we can heat that up overnight. That helps balance our load profiles and spreads out the most efficient use of these large centralized generators. But that's, I mean, we're, like, literally retiring the last coal power plants in the UK very imminently, you know, minus the current kind of, you know, winter, sort of, like, you know, last hurrah.
I think I've written about the last hurrah of coal at least three times now.
Yeah, I think now, like geopolitical as well as economic factors have kind of definitely made this the last hurrah. Like all you need to look at is Poland's adoption of heat pumps, and the skyrocketing volume of that because like domestic coal heating is still a kind of big chunk of Polish heating and how that has fundamentally changed in the last 18 months. But that's a different story. Anyway, like so it's a problem for an old it's an old world problem and it's an old world solution and it's not fit for a dynamic modern like bi-directional power flow energy system.
I remember we used to describe demand side response. We used to use this term negawatts, which I never quite got on board with. But it was this idea that demand side response was the same as generating capacity, right? It was just in the opposite direction. I suppose, Alex, how is demand side response different?
Well, I think it depends. First of all, you've got a bunch of different archetypes of energy users, right? You've got industrial users who have a very kind of clear, a kind of constrained way of how they use energy. You've got some, commercial users who have a little bit more flexibility on how they use it. And then you've got domestic consumers who are consumers. That means that they're fundamentally idiosyncratic, right? Like no one is going to do the exact same thing. And Tom, to your earlier example, like, in the old world, if you put about 200 households together, you had like the average national curve. That type of energy usage pattern is diverging rapidly as we electrify different parts of our lives more at pace. And this concept of like demand side response is literally just flattening the curve to or negawatts to your to your like your terminology, Emma, I think is kind of misplaced because if anything, we have fungibility in how and when we use energy. There's a price and a convenience factor that consumers are willing to pay or not or be rewarded for. And as we electrify more of our overall energy requirements, that actually comes with a huge amount of fungibility. And that fungibility is manifest in what we talk about, what we think about as intelligent demand, versus just a very kind of static, like, well, I'm just gonna turn down my consumption for these kind of set periods 4 times a year because that's how like my diversity of load forecast, static forecast predicts this part of the energy system to behave.
So the signals that we've got now are things like the triad. So you've got the 3 highest half hours in a year, separated by at least 10 working days between November and February, in a winter. You've got red, amber, green rates on GEOS, which are all, so those are kind of quasi-fixed periods. You've got set windows in which either a price will arrive, or you've got a rough idea in November to February, it's probably likely to be over the peak somewhere around that time. You've got Economy 7, which you talked about in terms of resistive heating, that just between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m., there's cheaper power available to some parties. What else have we got? We've got store, which is a kind of day ahead within certain windows. There might be some payments available. And there's the wholesale power price as well, but that's really only going to be useful for people who are half hourly settled, let alone half hourly metered. So, how does an intelligent demand customer know when to use, or is it a customer who and what is that, and how do they know what to do? And why aren't the signals that we've got now intelligent enough?
Great question. So I think if we unpack that and we kind of start at the top, so one triads, three, three highest price points of the year, then a kind of relatively static view of network charging of Duos. So for the listeners who are not deeply immersed in UK in UK nomenclature, so the distribution network use of system charges. And we've got wholesale, and then we've got and then the question of, well, who's actually reacting and how, right? So I think in the UK, we're in a winter peaking, we have a winter peaking grid. So, in that way, the system will continue to, like the energy system as a whole, will generally continue to be at its tightest in winter settings where you have a combination of kind of heating and just and general other load. Now, triads in their previous forms are moving away based on how that is being reformed. Whether that's right or wrong or the best outcome, I think we could probably park, because that'd probably be subject to a very spirited debate, although I'm pretty sure that the three of us at least will probably be on the same general wavelength. I like to kind of flip this around, Tom, and think about it in terms of where is the load growth on our energy system coming? And that load growth is primarily driven by two macro trends, and that is the electrification of transport and the electrification of heating, and the decarbonization of both of those elements, right? And so there's already very clear on the electrification of transport, we are on a rapid adoption curve. We're seeing, just gangbusters, quarter on quarter, year on year increases in number of electric vehicles registered and put on the road. And that's rapidly kind of, depending on where you are in the country, rapidly already dwarfing combustion engine vehicles. On the electrification of heating, a little bit behind the electrification of transport in terms of uptake. But the key thing for me when I think about this like macro problem statement is like all of that load growth is happening at low voltage distribution networks. Before it hits anywhere else, that load growth is happening at the very, very, like the very, very tail end of our energy kind of distribution system. It's not happening. It's not load that is plugged into the transmission system or even at medium voltage. The vast majority is happening in consumers' homes or in small businesses and kind of, on street parking, public charging infrastructure. And what we have to work on is how do we manage all of this load growth in a much more variable intermittent energy system where we will have peaks and troughs of abundance and shortage of overall energy demand, of overall energy generation, that we can move all of this load growth around to meet so that, the kind of the scorecard, at least in my mind, by the end of this decade is how much generation did we not curtail, not how much generation did we curtail. Because that then leads into let's not, we need to have a fine balance between making sure that we don't overbuild our generation capacity, because fundamentally that will cost consumers more. Because if we overbuild, we have a more expensive system because we have more generators that will maintain require to be made whole in some way or shape or form. But it's kind of that much more dynamic real-term balance regionally and nationally between intermittent generation and intelligent demand.
So in that you spoke about, how a lot of this is happening at the low voltage networks, but of course, with intermittency and changing generation fundamentals, that needs to come at the national level. Where do you see the signals for intelligent demand coming from? Where are they best placed?
So I think we're going to see them both at distribution and at transmission. So from an ESO TSO perspective, or I guess in GB we should probably talk about this as FSO now, as a future system operator. But you're going to need to balance, right? Because I might have a bunch of customers, for example, that have heat pumps and electric and or an electric vehicle on a in a specific part of the distribution system, like let's say a skinny feeder or a constrained secondary substation anywhere, whether it's Oxford or outside of Fort William, whatever. It doesn't matter where it is in the country. Like there could be a huge economic value in guaranteeing to that network operator that this amount of load is not going to hit their kind of capacity limits in specific periods of time. Conversely, I may also, receive either a wholesale market kind of price signal that incentivizes me to buy and consume more energy, and I will need to, you know, I as Octopus will need to make sure that we have the intelligence and the capability to portion out the different like parts of this portfolio and balance and balance that within our own kind of best outcomes economic decisions that take care of the customer needs and their requirements, take care of, you know, the stated kind of capacity limits on that and on that kind of secondary feeder out in Fort William, for example, as well as a kind of arguably different or like a or diametrically opposed wholesale price signal that would incentivize me to kind of, you know, consume more energy and deploy that across across my customers.
How, if at all, should those signals differ for demand side response? I mean, is it the case that demand side response, sorry, intelligent demand needs more notice, or that it's more real time, or a mix of both?
Great question. So I think we, you know, back to Tom's earlier point about Duos and the current red, amber, green pricing, I think that this needs to become dynamic and probably like locally dynamic, maybe first around primary substations and then evolving to secondary substations, which is something that will be possible as more and more network monitoring is deployed so that you can actually kind of really understand what's happening. And in conjunction, there needs to be that, you know, the clear understanding of what the pricing and value differentials are, because at different times it'll be, you know, it'll be more on a kind of a standalone basis more lucrative to follow like national prices, or in a world if we get to a world of of nodal pricing or zonal pricing, whichever flavor it ends up being, there's always going to be an overlay there between wholesale energy costs, whether they're national, and distribution kind of use of system costs. And I'll, you know, we will need to balance the outcomes there. And I think there's a big piece of work to be done there, though, on we can't just have pure play, like best outcome, best economic outcome decision-making, right? There needs to be some guardrails to make sure that there is deconfliction between a DSO kind of use of system charge signal and a wholesale price signal.
So you mentioned nodal and locational market pricing, so I hope you forgive me, Emma, for pouncing on that, because we do love a market design question. Do you think that well, the current design that I think is probably at the forefront of Bayes and National Grid when they're talking about LMP is a kind of central market dispatch where they alone have the view of the total system, and everyone sends them some information and they decide what everyone does. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the world you described is a bit different. It's where somebody before the market opens sets out what the network looks like, and then everyone trades around that, and that might change the outcome afterwards, and you get more of a self-dispatch LMP, but you have to have that upfront information. Have I characterized that correctly?
Yeah, it's a great point, Tom, and I think you have characterized that correctly. I think, you know, if we balance between the art of the possible and the timelines that we're working in, as an energy industry more broadly, moving from self-dispatch to centralized dispatch is a gargantuan lift on top of wholesale market reform, and at least at this point in time, I personally have not seen the pathway that gets us there with a degree of confidence to kind of really to stand behind and support a centralized dispatch model.
Having one party being able to optimize all of that is, I think, very challenging. Especially down to those levels, if you're talking down to the kind of, you know, if we need to balance signals at that level, which we will need to in order to avoid significant upgrade costs for this extra demand.
I suppose I do think it's a bit of a false dichotomy, though. I think, there's a grey area that we're already within. It's not a fully self-dispatch market currently. National Grid and DNOs do take actions ahead of gate closure, ahead of real time. They're increasingly looking to kind of move to the day-ahead stage, even for new balancing services. So I think we're already kind of a little bit way down that path, and probably where we'll end up, in my view, would be somewhere in between the two, some happy grey area.
I think, I mean, based on the way things are currently moving, I would not disagree with your kind of prediction, if you will.
So in this world where we have lots of electrified heating and electrified transport demand that's significantly increasing our overall demand for electricity, what actually technologies are going to allow them to participate in this way? How are we going to shift? How are they going to shift to times when there is an abundance of electricity, or shift away from periods where there is a lack of capacity? Like, do we need what needs to be there to enable this to happen? Do we need better communications systems, better metering architecture, forecasting? What missing steps or key enablers do we need to get to this world on a technological basis, and then maybe a business model basis as well?
Yeah, I think, maybe to address the last point first, I think the business models will be wide and varied. And I think as long as consumers are adequately protected and, their needs are paramount, and they're adequately guarded, I think we should expect and rightly see a proliferation of different business cases, from all of the buzzwords of X as a service to kind of complete integrated bundled smart tariffs to somewhere in between and other things that I haven't even conceived yet. But I think the key thing there is that it needs to be transparent. Consumers always need to be able to opt out. They always need to be able to exit and override. I think that's really that's the big thing on the kind of business model side. In terms of the technologies, I think, we have like very, very good smart metering infrastructure being installed in the SMETS 2 program. And one of the things we've done at Octopus is we've developed a CAD light. We call it the Home Mini. And that accesses the local meter point via the home area network that the meter creates, and we're then able to stream 10-second granularity reads of that boundary meter to Kraken, to our technology platform, and that's already an incredibly kind of, and that's leveraging the existing infrastructure, right, with just a little bit of extra technology deployed, and so I think there's not the bigger challenge is more on interoperability and standardizations of comms protocols for the different devices. So for the EVs, for the home chargers, for the heat pumps. At Octopus, we're fortunate, I should say, because we're a technology company. So different protocols, different standards, different integration pathways is not a, is not something that we see as a really huge challenge. But if we think about opening the market up, like you can definitely see how a better framework of like how do you connect to heat pumps in general or home batteries in general, EV charge points in general, definitely benefits the market as a whole.
So that's kind of smoothing the process between a trader saying, I want to sell 10 megawatts of energy tomorrow, through the communications then filtering down to all of the database of all of the meter points and all of the connected heat pumps, that then sends off a signal down the, is it the 5G, 4G, whatever G network that the smart meters use, to then ping a signal to that asset to then not consume at that period. And that track all the way down needs to be interoperable to be as smooth as possible, to enable as many participants as possible to take that possible action.
I mean, in many ways, Tom, I think the interesting way that I think about it, and this comes down to like what's the underlying technology platform that you're enabling is, or that you're building upon. And if we think of, if we take a macro, if we take a big step back, we're moving from a world of a few hundred big generators that are dispatched to meet a relatively static demand curve to tens of thousands, soon hundreds, or if not hundreds of thousands of generators connected at different points of the energy, different voltage levels of the energy system, and millions of devices that are being orchestrated and managed to some degree or another. And that's a fundamental kind of flip. You're basically flipping the whole system on its head. And the underlying technology platform to enable that is really key. Like you have to have a modern infrastructure that is able to adjust and kind of ingest that volume of data, process it in something that is, vaguely comprehensible to allow you to make those decisions that you just said. Like a trader wants to move, wants to offload 10 megawatts in this settlement period and dump it into another. Or ideally, maybe he wants to not just dump it and not have to buy it again. In which case you then have that complicated thing of so how do we convince consumers in that group that actually they don't need that energy kind of thing? And that's a really kind of interesting problem to solve.
I guess the kind of very fascinating thing as well is the idea of planning your load is, flipping it on its head and planning your load around the generation. And that both seems like a technical challenge, but also a social one. So the technical challenge is forecasting correctly to get it, which we're not so bad at, but again, it depends. I think there's forecasting it the day ahead isn't so bad, but some of these, will we be able to do weeks ahead? Because there's some big industrial processes, for example, aren't going to be able to flip over from one day to the next, but perhaps EVs and heat pumps might be able to, ? And then there's the social, is how do you convince someone? What kind of signal do you send at the household or smaller consumer level to actually move that consumption?
I think one of the challenges here, and this is where the kind of the bridging the gap between what a system price and what a market is priced at, and how the offer and kind of program is communicated to consumers, is something where we really should divorce and not think about it in kind of a like for like kind of pass through. So if we put our, put our energy geek hats down and go to the pub with our friends who work in other industries, I don't think anyone knows, honestly, even in the current situation, I don't think anyone really could be able to equate what £3 per kilowatt hour actually really means. But what I think is something that could be enticing to consumers is, hey, over this winter, you'll be given 30 chances to just reduce your consumption in a given period of time. It'll be somewhere between 1 and 3 hours long. If you do more than 50% of them, you'll get 100 quid or 150 quid off your bill on an annual basis. Like, that is a consumer offer that, you could talk about your friends at the pub with. And so, the demand flexibility service has just been introduced. It's the first time that a service is this broad in terms of really kind of making monetization available for the vast majority of the demand side that isn't in the BM, and that's basically almost all of demand, right? And there's a huge opportunity to build on this and iterate the business models and how you engage with your CNI customers versus your small and medium, your small and medium business customers versus your domestic customers. And I think it's on the supplier or whoever the third party is to shape those offerings, to iterate those offerings. Because the reality is that it's going to be an iterative process about how these things kind of get embedded into an energy supply agreement, for example.
I like what you said about kind of separating out the system price from the price of the customer, or I suppose the ultimate deal that the customer is facing. I suppose in your mind, is the future a world where we have, I suppose, real-time prices that the supplier is facing, or I suppose sharp, reflective prices that the supplier is facing, but its role is the intermediary to try and manage those, hedge those on behalf of the customer, and as you say, kind of package up an offer. Maybe it's, you know, a fixed price if you give them control of your flexible things or anything like that. But is that kind of how you see it? And is that role for real-time pricing important in your mind?
So I think short answer is yes. I think there's a very clear role to be played as an intermediary, and not one that is, you know, just creaming incremental margin, but one to kind of manage that risk and give customers certainty to a degree. And like, you know, as we move from a 30-minute settlement window to a 15-minute settlement window, maybe eventually to a 5-minute settlement window, like that becomes more and more relevant, right? Like no one is like already reacting on a half hourly basis manually. One-off events, sure, that works. Like every day, absolutely. Let's be honest, that doesn't work, right? It needs automation, and you really need to focus on, back to the earlier point, what are the big load growth areas? The electrification of heat and transport. Like, I think that's where the value is sitting. That's where the value is sitting for the consumers who are electrifying those loads. That's where the value is sitting for the supplier, and that's where the value for the energy system as a whole is sitting. And managing that complexity and disintermediating that complexity in the form of a viable financial offer is, I think, one of the key ways in which we scale this. So as an example, our Intelligent Octopus EV smart charging tariff divorces all of the complexity of that. And it basically is a very simple financial prop that says, dear Mr. Customer, if you give Octopus the ability to manage your car charging schedule on your behalf, with your input, with your needs as at the top of the merit order, so when the car needs to be ready by and what state of charge you want it at, we will give you a 75% discount on your unit rate for whenever we charge the car. Like, that's a super simple proposition, right? And you know, on the basis of that, we've been able to build in less than a year's time an almost 100 megawatt, almost 1 gigawatt hour virtual power plant made up exclusively of EV charging.
I was just going to note, I think that I was doing some research on EV charging for forecasting EV load out to 2050, and we talked to our consumer team, and they reckon that you've got 10% of the EV in total of the market, and basically all of the flexibility when we did our market share.
Maybe. I think somewhere between 10 to 15%.
Oh, okay. I'll tell them that. I might have to update my model then.
You mentioned different types of customers, different customer archetypes. I was wondering if you could dig into that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think, you know, one of the challenges is that, as we talked about at the beginning, right, we're moving away from 250 households in a given part of town in aggregate form that, you know, the national average, because you're just having wildly different types and stages of electrification, so stages of load growth in some ways, and also just different living patterns. Like, a lot of people are not commuting 9 to 5, 5 days a week. The impact of the last few years has accelerated an already growing trend of like much more hybrid work-life balances and kind of working from home, etc. And so so you combine those kind of macro trends with electrification trends, and so suddenly you have this explosion of different archetypes. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, when we think about creating tariffs and creating different types of offers for customers, they're tailored for different types of consumers. So, you know, we've talked about Intelligent Octopus, you know, or the EV Intelligent Octopus, very tailored at electric vehicle owners. We also have Agile, which is a dynamic time of use tariff where every half hour is indexed to the wholesale price with a very simple kind of pricing formula. That's tailored at people who really want to engage with the energy, like energy prices, and can reliably or kind of are able to shift their loads around to take advantage of that. But that's not for everyone, right? But that is for a subset of consumers that want that amount in the same way. And whereas other customers, and I'm going to, like, you know, suspend current you know, energy price guarantee and kind of flattening of prices. But, you know, you then have a difference between consumers who want a fixed 6, 9, 12 month, 24 month tariff versus those who would like a variable tariff. And that's kind of analogous to, you know, some consumers go for tracker mortgages, some consumers go for variable or for fixed mortgages. And so, you know, as you look at that, you start having quite a big diversity of customer archetypes. And they're, you know, they're tied to technology adoption curves, they're tied to lifestyle, they're tied to geographic location, they're tied to other, you know, socioeconomic index factors. And you really, like, I think as we move forward in this world of a net zero system and intelligent demand, it's the opportunity of the suppliers to and kind of third party aggregators and optimization like service providers to understand who they're serving, how they're best serving those customers, how they're delivering value to the customer, and also delivering value to themselves and to the.
In terms of kind of market reforms that are ongoing, you mentioned iterating and changing over time and kind of shortcutting. Do you think the best route to getting to this kind of intelligent demand world is via things like REMA, or is it via like National Grid coming up with new centralized balancing services that eventually morph into market? REMA is, for listeners who may be new, REMA is the Review of Electricity Market Arrangements. It's about designing a wholesale market that can deliver on the government's net zero ambitions by 2035. And, or is it just a case of suppliers will in the background iterate and develop new products outside of the kind of formal industry structure? What do you think is the best route forward, or is the route forward? And do you have any views on REMA? Because I'd be interested in hearing.
Ooh, Tom, let's not open the REMA can of worms, because I think that could be a very, very long discussion. But I mean, I think if I kind of rephrase your question, is like what's the most effective way at innovating quickly and kind of getting to where we think we need to be to kind of get to this intelligent demand world? And I think I'm personally a huge believer in iterating in the real world. And I think especially when it comes to consumers, whether those are, you know, industrial, commercial, or domestic consumers, nothing is more pertinent and more real than having real world products out there that you're consistently improving on and changing and improving. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges of the energy industry as a whole, because we've come from a place and a world where innovation is a very kind of, you know, multi-stage gated thing, where we have very structured innovation programs. They're multi-year running. We have a huge degree of oversight, because the last thing we want to do is rock the boat too much. Because, you know, in the previous world, you know, we're talking about like maybe some hardware changes or some, you know, the way that, you know, a transformer was actually designed or run or operated. So like, you know, you really wanted a high degree of validation and certainty on how that would done. So absolutely, you know, fit for purpose on how these innovation programs have been designed. But the reality is that the world has now changed. Like, there are still those needs to kind of, there's still the needs for some innovation programs to run and follow that course when you're validating how smart transformers would work, for example. But if you're trying to do like, how do we engage consumers in the energy ecosystem and do that in a kind of time warped innovation program that run parallel at, like, you know, in a time dilation field relative to the real world, you know, you finish those programs and it's like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock, that, you know, we solved that like 3 years ago. We're like on like V10 now. And I think that's, I have to commend National Grid ESO balancing team for, you know, how quickly we were able to partner with them and stand up the big dirty turndown in February and March of this year, which kind of proved that Control Room actually had a resource that was, you know, actually viable on a day ahead basis to kind of shape national demand. And that was then productionized within the space of a few months into the demand flexibility service. That will continue to evolve and change, right? Like, there, like, we've got the local congestion management program happening on the B6 boundary on the border of Scotland and England that, you know, I think will also be very interesting to see how that pans out and like the growth of these like national versus regional markets. And so I think, you know, coming back to your question, I think, you know, we really see when it especially comes to load growth, and that's a lot of consumer and demand-led load growth, you have to iterate in the real world. We do not have the time to spend on a 4 or 5 year innovation program that, you know, that is then fundamentally dated, not just a little dated, but fundamentally dated by the time it finishes, let alone to then how you get to talking about introducing it into BAU.
I suppose the only concern I guess I have with constant iteration is it's all very complicated. And I guess what do we need to do to take customers on this journey? And also, what do we need to have in place to protect customers that are more vulnerable?
I think, you know, therein lies the crux of our challenge fundamentally, right? Like as we move faster and faster into a net zero energy system, that comes with a lot of challenges. And I think how we manage and how we take care of vulnerable customers and how we, and not just vulnerable customers, but customers overall, I think is incredibly important, because it's so easy to lose trust, to lose consumer trust. I mean, just, I think we all have personal examples of, like, you know, you order a service, or you buy a service, or you order something online, and it works well the first 3 or 4 times. And then just, you know, one time something goes wrong. And more times than not, you are then just like, I'm never ordering from X again. And it's the same reality in the energy industry. And I think it's something that, as an industry of providing a core utility, is completely anathema, because we still have, in many respects, as large parts of the energy industry are monopolies. And so, like, the concept that consumers have choice and can walk is currently, like, still, you know, 20 years after deregulation, still kind of this new dawning little light amongst different segments of the industry. And I think, and we need to move into a world of not just paying lip service to putting to the term of prosumer, or putting the consumer at the center, but of the energy system, but actually doing it, giving them a voice, giving them value. And like, you know, if we look at any other industries, value accrues to whoever serves the customer best, and serving them best is taking care of them, right? And so, like, these things come hand in hand as far as I'm concerned.
I think we might have covered it in real-time pricing. Yeah, I suppose penalties in electricity is often a dirty word, but I guess you can also call it performance incentives. And we want the performance incentive in electricity to be quite strong, because the, you know, that failing, you know, we get ourselves into problems of blackouts and that kind of thing. Do you see demand and intelligent demand and demand flexibility as, should there be the same kind of performance incentives, aka penalties, for demand side response as there is for generation?
I think as these markets mature and scale up, I think that is absolutely something that needs to be very thoughtfully considered, because otherwise, you know, otherwise how can you rely on a service or on a type of asset fundamentally? I think the balance is in deciding on the how and the when and how you phase that in. I think there's also a lot of sins are hidden through the socialization of cost, right? You know, the average consumer doesn't know that their balancing costs have risen exponentially in the last 3 years. And that's because the average consumer doesn't understand the makeup of the cost stack that makes up the price that they pay per kilowatt hour. But that's a kind of roundabout way of saying, I do think that performance incentives are something that need to be thought about and structured in a way that, you know, as intelligent demand management becomes more and more of a central feature of energy system management and balancing, then of course it stands to reason that whoever is providing that service should, you know, be, you know, be penalized if they do not deliver to it, you know, within a within the schema or within the framework of the services they're providing. Because I mean, otherwise we have a recreation of the capacity market, where, yeah.
No comment.
I don't know. I mean, how do you guys?
Yeah, we all rolled our eyes.
My video is off, but that's exactly what I was doing.
Thank you, Alex, for joining us and talking about intelligent demand. I'm really excited about the idea of demand conforming to generation. And I'd be one of those customers who's seeking out, like, oh, it's going to be windy, I'm going to turn everything on. If there's a signal for me to do so.
Can I just say, I'd be one of those customers that would want someone to do that for me. So I'll hand over control of my flexible things and they can do it and then I can do other things. I think that's where I fall in the spectrum of customers.
Yeah. I mean, if it were cheap enough for me to get a terminal and to get a BSC account, I would do that and just trade my own meter. But that's a dream maybe for the future at some point when the cost of all of that has come down. But yeah, thank you for talking through that with us. You've been listening to the Substation Podcast. You can contact us at thesubstationpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter while it still exists at Notional Grid. You can follow Emma at @energy_burns. Alex, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Oh, I mean, just first of all, thank you for having me. You guys are great. Love the show.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Yeah, look forward to hearing the next episode.